When she gets there, she knows if the stores are all closed. With a word, she can get what she came for.
P96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Thursday, January 23rd. A Manatee County Commissioner has started a discussion about a building moratorium for the district he represents. Bob McKent's District 5 includes Lakewood Ranch, one of the fastest growing new developments in the United States. The Republican who ran on slow development said, quote, "I got 42,000 votes that said, hey, stop the building." Now he would like a one-year building moratorium for residential construction to make sure steps are taken to prevent future flooding and to catch up on infrastructure. At least two of his fellow commissioners seem supportive. Carol Feltz and Jason Bearden suggested they are willing to consider the idea, but asked to be more specific. George Cruz said a moratorium would be too broad. Commissioner Mike Rand said he's 100% against it. Rex Jensen, who heads the company that has developed Lakewood Ranch, said a moratorium would be illegal. Senate Bill 250 currently prohibits moratoria in any county within 100 miles of where Hurricane Ian or Nicole made landfall. Jensen indirectly threatened to sue, but offered a, quote, face-to-face meeting in which we share the facts about flooding, leaving the politics aside, unquote. Meanwhile, another Manatee County Commissioner is calling for the removal of fluoride from the county's drinking water. Amanda Ballard added the discussion of fluoride to the agenda of the upcoming commission meeting next Tuesday. With that, she followed a national debate about whether fluoride poses health risks for children. This is a decades-old practice to reduce tooth decay and oral disease, especially in underserved communities. Sarasota County Government will hold a job fair tomorrow. Hiring managers will be on site to screen and interview job seekers this Friday, January 24th, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Jacaranda Library in Venice. Jobs are available in public utilities, public works, breeze transit, general services, parks, recreation and natural resources, fire emergency services, planning and development services, and special programs. To view all job openings or to apply online, visit scgov.net/jobs. This has been Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Thursday, January 23rd.
Welcome to The Detail. I am your host, Kathy Antunes, and you are listening to The Detail on WSLR 96.5, LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, and WBPV 100.1 LPFM in Bradenton, Florida. With me today is the conscience of Sarasota, Carrie Seidman. Spent 14 years at the Herald Tribune. The last seven of those years, she was a columnist, often writing three columns a week. It was quite a run, but she became known in our community as a voice of reason and a voice of the people. Carrie wrote her last column for the Herald Tribune on Christmas Eve. It was published, and I'm hoping she's going to spill a little tea about what's going on. About her departure and what she's going to do next. Carrie Seidman, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for asking me, Kathy.
Yeah, and it is Seidman, right?
It is Seidman, although I respond to Seidman or Seidman because phonetically it really should be Seidman, but yeah. my family pronounced it Seidman.
Okay. So I have to say the first time, I wouldn't blame you if you didn't want to talk to me, because the very first time we met, this was at Selby Library, and I had organized Alito Pavilion strategy meeting.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And this was when you know, the forces in the city of Sarasota had kind of gathered to make what opponents like me considered it to be a spring break bar that would have been happening at Lido Pavilion. And you lived on Lido, and you came really as a resident to join other citizens. And because you were with the paper, I said, no, you really can't be here. And I kicked you out.
I do remember that.
And you, I remember you're just crestfallen, looked on your face. And you're like, but I live there. And I was like, I know, but like, we, like, this is a strategy meeting. You work for the paper. And I just didn't know you. And you didn't sit in on our strategy meetings in the future, but you certainly were.
I didn't, though. I did certainly get behind your efforts. Because since I've moved here, Lido has been my beach, you know, yes, my place. And I was so much in support of what you were trying to prevent them turning it into a much more commercial place. So.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that one. But yeah, I think those spaces and what Lido Beach represented for so many of us, and certainly, you know, we did prevail on that issue. But it was one of those old Florida, laid back, family friendly, quiet, you know, it had that vibe, and we were able to preserve that vibe. And you have taken, you know, I would call it a resident-friendly, common-sense-friendly stance in your columns during a time when, you know, I write about dark money, and we've just seen this capture of special interest money having way a disproportionate impact in local elections. And so I think so many people are sad that you're not going to be writing for the Herald Tribune anymore. You spent 14 years there.
Yeah.
And then half of those years you were a columnist. Can you, you know, tell us how you got to Sarasota and then how you got into writing for the Herald Tribune?
I actually was working in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Mm. This is in, you know, the early 2000s. And for a wonderful paper that no longer exists called the Albuquerque Tribune. And unfortunately, like so many papers in this country, it went out of business. And I wasn't at an age where I was really ready to retire. There really wasn't another place for me to go to there. I contemplated going into academia and teaching journalism, and I kind of was set on that route. And then I discovered that the Sarasota Herald Tribune was advertising for several positions, which was unusual because every other paper in the country was getting rid of people. Mm. And at the time, the paper here was owned by the New York Times. And I had worked for the New York Times at the beginning of my career in New York. So I had an established relationship with them. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, well, okay, here is a very good community paper, which it was at the time, and owned by the New York Times, so it's stable. And, mm-hmm. you know, if I'm going to move on and make a big move, this would be a good place to go. Yeah. So so I came and I interviewed, and I was offered a position here. And after 20 years in Albuquerque, I moved across the country. And 3 months after I got here, the New York Times sold all of their regional papers, including this one. And it was the first of three ownership changes during my time at the Herald Tribune. Mm. And each one kind of took the paper down a peg in terms of staff and money and
resources.
And resources.
Diana McFarlane was the publisher.
She was at that time.
At that time. Mm-hmm. And she had been a longstanding publisher, widely respected, and was offered a position then in Gainesville to take over the dean position for their journalism school.
Right.
And so I had looked at, you know, some of what you've written about your career arc there. And Bill Church came in And he really kind of, you had told him some of the things you'd like to do, and he said, you go, right? He basically...
Yeah, I have a real debt of gratitude to Bill. The paper was without an editor after that transition. When it was sold, it was sold from the New York Times to a private equity company, and it was actually without an executive editor for almost a year. And then Bill came in, and Bill is a great guy. He's still in the newspaper business. We butted heads often enough, but he recognized, I think, what I was capable of and gave me some opportunities to really go for it and found the money for me to do some really interesting long-form journalism. At that time, I wasn't a columnist. I was actually a member of the art staff.
Okay.
But I did several really, for me, memorable long-form pieces. One was about a woman, an elderly woman who actually was a friend of mine, who decided to end her own life, although she was did not have a terminal illness. She was just elderly, and she was 86, and she had no family left, and she decided to end her life by stopping eating and drinking.
Yeah.
And agreed to allow me. She assembled a team of friends to help her with this process and offered me the opportunity to write about it. And it turned into kind of a tragic tale about how difficult it was. So that was a really meaningful story that had a lot of discussion around it because, of course, it was very controversial. And the other major story that Bill supported was for me and a photographer, Elaine Litherland, to go to Cuba with a group of dancers from a studio here in Sarasota that was founded by two former Cuban dancers who defected to the U.S. in the 90s, and they were taking their son, who had was just starting his ballet training, back to Cuba to compete in an international competition there.
Wow.
And so we went to Cuba for a week and wrote this wonderful story about this family reuniting, you know, with their roots, and also about Cuba itself, because so many people had so much curiosity about what was happening there. And
well, the arts section of the paper is certainly important anywhere, but especially here in Sarasota. There's such an interest in the arts, and we form our identity around supporting the arts. But you also wrote a series called Facing Mental Illness. And I think that was a real community service. How did that come about, and what was the scope and the...
Well, another story that I did during the time after I first moved here, my son had a mental health crisis. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't living in Florida at the time I moved him here, and discovered how very difficult it was to get adequate mental health services in Florida. And I ended up writing a story about my journey trying to get him help and about the stigma of having a diagnosis like schizophrenia. And that story was also very well received. It received a media award from a group called Mental Health America, which is the largest grassroots mental health nonprofit here in the U.S. And that led to me applying for a fellowship from the Carter Center in Atlanta. Rosalind Carter had a program that she started probably 40 years ago now, to train journalists to write about mental health in a more equitable way. And Bill Church actually encouraged me to apply for that fellowship, and I was honored to be one of 9 journalists in the U.S. to win the fellowship, and it provided money for me to come back to Sarasota and do a year-long project. And my project involved weekly profiles in the paper of someone who had been through a mental health crisis and was in recovery. And it also had an art component. We invited anyone with any kind of mental health condition to create a self-portrait that kind of put into their portrait how they felt about their challenges. And that ended up creating an art show with over 80 pieces of art that hung in the gallery of the hung in the Selby Library, a rotunda, for a month. And it was a very meaningful project for me.
Yeah, I think that, you know, when you have someone you love that has gone through, because I have that situation with someone in my family, and it is, you can't know what that's like unless you've gone through it. And I'm curious to, you know, long ago, there was a New York Times bestseller written by a psychiatrist. It was called The Road Less Traveled by M. Scott Peck.
Sure.
And he said that all mental illness is comes about because of the avoidance of legitimate suffering. That, in other words, there's coping mechanisms that people build to avoid feeling real pain, you know, typically. I mean, it's just things that are truly, truly difficult. And that kind of always stuck with me because, you know, this life, I don't care who you are, you're going to be facing things that are hard. Nobody is, nobody is exempt, right? I think there's this story about the Buddha who, a woman comes to him with her baby died. She's got her baby, and she says, how could this happen? How could God let this happen to me? And he said, I want you to go around in the village and ask each household if they've ever gone through anything like you've gone through. So she comes back in about a week, and she just says, okay, I understand, because everybody has, right? Some kind of loss.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is a genetic component to some mental illness, especially some severe mental illnesses. But yes, absolutely. I also happen to be one of the co-founders of a group in Sarasota that's called Sarasota Strong, which is based on the idea that we that people have suffered trauma in their life, and that trauma has often led to their behaviors. And so it's trying to create a community that's much more informed about trauma and its impacts and provides trauma-informed care. So that's a huge, I mean, I think when you go through, when you have a loved one who has a mental health crisis, for me it was a huge learning experience to go through it with my son, because I realized that there were so many components beyond medication that were important in his stability and in his recovery. Yeah. And you learn that it's things that we all need, you know. We all need, you know, healthy food and enough sleep and a sense of community and a sense of purpose and
a stable place to live.
Yeah, and all of those things are a factor in our mental health.
Yeah. So many wonderful things you've done, and those 7 years, you know, you were doing these kind of projects. Then you became a columnist, and, you know, I want to get to some of the issues you wrote about that I've found, you know, important, and I want to know what your favorites were. But, you know, Carrie, I think your departure from the newspaper was surprising to a lot of people. I mean, you're obviously still very, like, it's not like you're ready to stop working necessarily, or at least I don't see that.
Right.
So do you care to tell us what went on there?
Well, I don't think I need to go great into great specifics. A lot of people were not aware that I was no longer on the staff of the paper. When Gannett bought the paper in 2020, I took a buyout because I could kind of see the writing on the wall of what was coming. However, my leaving at that point was largely dictated by the fact that I was working under an editor that I really struggled to work with, and I was had requested to move to a different editor, and that was not permitted. So
I think I know who that was.
I'm not going to mention it because I've mentioned his name before and gotten in, gotten retribution. So I'll let you guessing at that one.
Yeah.
But what happened was after I took the buyout, a couple months later, that editor was fired. And so then I was interested in coming back. And what happened was they had a rule that if you had taken a buyout, you couldn't write for them for a year.
Okay.
So it was actually a little bit less than a year. But then there was a columnist named Kathy Silverberg who'd been writing for the editorial page and for a long time. And she decided to retire. And I contacted the paper and asked them if they'd be interested in having me do a column. And that's when I came back. But what that meant was that I was not on the staff. I was considered a freelance writer.
Okay.
And so that also meant I had none of the benefits or privileges or inclusion of someone on the staff. And that became kind of a bone of contention for me because I was being used and promoted
as a staff writer.
To be honest, my columns did very well. I brought the paper a good audience. They were usually in the top 5 or 10 stories of the week, you know. Mm-hmm. And I was looking to have my work a little bit more respected as important to the paper.
Mm-hmm.
One of the biggest bones of contention was that I didn't have access to the website without buying a subscription.
I don't know what to say to that.
It's
you
okay.
had to buy.
Well,
what?
I did, yeah, because I didn't. I mean, staff writers obviously have access to the website and the software and the content system that they use and so forth. As a freelancer, I didn't have that. And so there were things that I felt were preventing me from doing what I could do. I wasn't included in staff meetings. I wasn't, you know, I don't have access to the newspaper's newsroom. There were things that I felt like I could, and it didn't involve me asking for more money, but there were things that I felt like they could use me for and get much more for the small amount of money that I was being paid. Mm-hmm. So just to make a long story short, I requested this fall, I requested a meeting with the editors to discuss some of these things that I was concerned about and said, you know, I'd like to resolve them before the end of the year. And they did not get back to me. And then when they did finally get back to me, they just said that, you know, they decided to, quote, honor my decision to leave.
Really?
Because I had said, if we can't resolve these things, then I don't think I can continue.
But that's different from saying, you said, I don't think, I mean, that's, okay, so.
I was very disappointed that they chose not to even have a conversation with me about it, because I really do believe that if we had had a conversation about it, we could have resolved the issues, and I would still be writing the column. So, you know, there is a bit of hurt there on my side after 14 years of real, I feel like I gave the paper everything I could, and I feel like I did some really good work while I was there. And it's kind of a disappointing way to have it terminate.
You know. You put so much of your heart into that work. It is, I can imagine, disappointing to find that they're not even wanting to talk to you about.
Yeah, it was a disappointment, and you know. And I had wrote about this in my last column. Being a columnist is very different than being a reporter. I was a reporter for most of my life, and I loved it. And nothing not to diminish being a reporter at all. And I think I was a decent columnist because I had been a reporter for so long. But when you are sharing your personal opinion, when right. your picture appears with your column. When your phone number and email appear at the end of every column, as mine did, you have a very different relationship with readers than you do as a reporter.
Yes.
And I often wrote about personal things in my column as a way to get into, you know, what many people were feeling. And so, you know, after doing it for so many years, many readers felt like they really knew me. And I had.
And in a way, they did.
Yeah. And I had many
shared a lot.
Ongoing, years long email and phone conversations with readers.
You invited people to Thanksgiving.
Yeah. That's the thing people always remember. But,
very generous.
I started a tradition a number of years ago of opening up my house on Thanksgiving for a reader appreciation day, is what I called it. And was. Such a wonderful event, and people from all over the county actually came, and most people didn't know each other. Most people I didn't know, other than having, you know, shared an email or a phone conversation with them. And it was just a great, you know, feel-good, come-together event.
Which is why I think so many people, I mean, I never went to Thanksgiving at your house, but, you know, reading your columns and knowing that about you, people do feel like they know you.
Yeah, I that's what I really miss. I miss, you know, I miss that exchange with my readers. I miss feeling like I was serving the community in a positive way.
You know, Carrie. So I know so many people are sorry to see you go, and I don't know, like, there doesn't seem to be anybody there. Like, we used to have, back in, like, 2008, 2010, Ernie Ernst wrote for the paper. He was a columnist, and Tom Lyons. Like, we used to have two columnists that were very resident-oriented, citizen-oriented. They were watchdogs. You know,
right.
Then we just kind of had one, right? In recent years, you're it. Now it feels like there aren't any. I mean, who's writing for the Herald Tribune that takes that kind of watchdog role?
Well, there is no columnist, local columnist anymore. The whole opinion page changed a lot when, in the past couple of years, they got rid of all their nationally syndicated columnists, and they use primarily USA Today, which is Gannett columnists. With my departure, there is no local columnist other than the opinion editor, Roger Brown, who does not do the kind of columns I did at all.
And God bless Roger. I mean, I like Roger. Everyone's a nice guy, right? I always say that. When they endorsed, and I don't know who the editorial board is, although, it, you know, obviously Roger's there. But when they endorsed Kevin Van Ostenbridge, it was like when you told me you didn't have it was a little more than that, when you didn't have access to the news, my jaw dropped. When they endorsed Kevin Van Ostenbridge for Manatee County Commissioner, I was shocked because it just seemed how people feel. Do you not know what this man has done on the dais, the way he's conducted himself, the things that he's said? Like, what, does he just come in and these things and you just forget all that? Or did you even know it to begin with? You have any thoughts on what went on there?
Well, I'm limited in what I want to say here. Okay. The paper has not had an editorial board for many, many years. When I first arrived in 2010, there were probably at least four or five people still in the editorial department, that gradually an opinion editor, and that was Tom Tryon for many years, who did a wonderful job reaching out to the community, talking with community leaders, inviting them in, writing really thoughtful local editorials. Mm-hmm. And then when Tom retired, Barbara Peter-Smith was the editor for a brief amount of time. And before Roger came in. But essentially, there has been no editorial board for many, many years. And the executive editor, Mark Rochester, which was about a year and a half ago, I suggested that they start a citizens advisory board, which could serve as somewhat of a editorial board, and offered to help pull that together, and I wasn't asking them to make it a job. I wasn't asking for more money. I just felt it was really important that there be more input into these decisions and endorsements.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you're saying this, and because you're saying they really have an editorial, but they do say the editorial board, quote unquote.
Well, the editorial board at prior, now I will say that 2 weeks after I left, they announced that they were forming a citizens advisory board, and they are now putting that together.
But
prior, when they said that it was a decision of the editorial board, that was Roger Brown, the opinion editor, and the executive editor, Mark Rochester. There is no other editorial board.
Okay, because I'm familiar with that call for citizen advisors, and as many of my listeners know, there's a group I moderate with Tom Matrullo on Facebook called Citizens for Sarasota County. I posted that, and it was familiar because they ran that same call a few years back, and people wrote and said, I applied, I never heard back.
Yeah,
than one person.
Roger actually wrote a column after I had talked to Mark about it, saying that they were calling for citizen advisors. This is prior to the election.
Yeah.
And many, many people I know, many of my readers wrote in and offered, and all of them said that they didn't even receive a form acknowledgement. When I asked Roger about it at that time, he told me we're too busy doing endorsements and doing interviews and so forth. I think they ultimately endorsed three or four races. And
but can I stop you there? Because
sure.
It's interesting to me that they felt that it was because they had embraced a policy years back that they were not going to be doing endorsements anymore.
Right.
And then with not even really a full board, they decided they were going to do endorsements, which, I think if you're going to endorse people and you say you have an editorial board, there should actually be one, right, instead of just a handful.
When they said that they were going to bring back endorsements, I was actually very pleased, because readers really want endorsements.
Okay.
But I also feel like if you are going to do endorsements, you really have to know, you really have to be following what's going on. And I think I don't think anyone in the editorial positions at the paper had done the kind of homework that you have to do,
right,
to do endorsements. It's a lot of work. I didn't endorse people in my column. I didn't ever talk about individual candidates in my column because I didn't. Mm-hmm. I always felt that my role was as community columnist, and it was to inform people. And I certainly, if there was someone running for office who I felt was already in office and not doing a good job, which I won't name any names either, but
okay.
There is a certain county commissioner who I wrote about frequently because I wanted people to be informed. I didn't say don't vote for him, but I right. said be aware that this is, you
this
know,
is happen-
this
XYZ
is happening.
Is happening.
But yeah. So I think if you're going to do endorsements, yes, you have to do much more than a half an hour interview with each candidate, which is basically what was done.
And so. You know, here's the thing. It's a local paper. And it's been my experience since I started paying close attention in 2008. And when I say close attention, even I don't know everything. I mean, there's a lot happening locally, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so if you're going to put yourself in the position of evaluating, to your point, you really do need to know what's going on. And that actually is not a simple thing. There's usually a lot of information that you need to evaluate. And this may be kind of very related to why we're seeing a problem with local journalism. If the local paper doesn't take enough interest in local issues to really inform themselves about what's going on before they would opine as to who you ought to vote for, should the local paper be surprised that they're struggling? You know, because there are, I think, enough people out there, mavens of local politics, that recognize this is not being covered, that's not being covered, this endorsement doesn't make sense. So if local journalism is going to thrive, you actually need folks who are working in that arena, who value what's going on at the local level. And this may seem so obvious, but is that what we're getting? And in all fairness, I totally understand the pressure, the money pressure. I want a thriving local paper. I think people do, you know, they want a paper that's going to be valuable. So, and there's a way that we live in a celebrity worship type culture that has far more implication than just the Kardashians. I mean, I think I'm not really looking to the Herald Tribune to give me the scoop on the White House. I'm looking for what's going on here, and I'm concerned that we're not really getting that the way we need to. What are your thoughts on the state of local journalism and that, you know, that point about is it even valued by the local paper?
I think there are two issues here. One is that the paper is now owned by Gannett, which is USA Today. And Gannett runs its local papers. It has many local papers, and its MO, and it's economically driven, is to have smaller staffs, to regionalize the news, and to share the news amongst its papers. So if you open the Herald Tribune or you open the Palm Beach Post, you're going to see a lot of the same content. And it's going to be state content rather than local content. And that is a model that they use to make the economics work better for them. So it's a response to the contraction of the newspaper world. Probably no one knows better than you and I how much it takes to really cover local issues and the local community. It's a lot of work. I mean, people thought, oh, well, Carrie's only writing one column a week, no big deal. But, you know, often that one column a week, there were two or three or even 4 days of meetings and interviews and research and so forth that go into it. So it takes people, it takes money, and it takes, you know, there are very few people left at the paper who have in Sarasota a long time. I mean, I remember Roger asking me at one time, and I said, oh, no, I've only lived here since 2010. And he said, well, I'm really surprised because you seem to know everyone and you seem to really know all the issues. That's because I really work my butt off trying to. And I think, unfortunately, there's all Mr. Rochester has written in a recent editorial saying, you know, that they're very devoted to local coverage and that they're going to be doing more investigative work and so forth. And it would be wonderful if that is the case.
Yeah.
I don't see how it's going to happen with the current staff, with the current budget. And you just got rid of your only local columnist, so it's a little hard to see how that's going
to
happen.
Everybody, if you're just joining us, my guest is Carrie Seidman. Carrie has written a local column for the Herald Tribune for the past 7 years, but she departed at the end of 2024. Prior to that, she worked for 7 years as a reporter. You are listening to The Detail on WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, and WBPV 100.1 LPFM in Bradenton, Florida. Programming at WSLR is supported by listeners like you and by Ringling College Galleries and Exhibitions. Ringling College's 2024-25 exhibition season features art from Ringling students, alumni, faculty, and nationally recognized artists from a wide range of mediums and from diverse backgrounds. More information is available at ringlingcollege.gallery. And so, Carrie Seidman, I want to get to some of your columns. There's actually a trilogy of columns. I'm calling them the apologies. it was interesting because sometimes our local happenings make national news, right? They actually do. You had written an open letter of apology to Brennan Asplund for how he was treated. You had written a column about Bridget Ziegler is not going to leave. We all need to get used to it, but that she does owe us an apology for her behavior. And then most recently, Kyle Batty for putting out a false Facebook post about Kelly Franklin, framed her as a racist. That was really concerning because how did it ever get on a city agenda? Something that was put in at the last minute, that wasn't vetted, that was clearly false. Care to comment on those issues? Because it's been so important in these times when we're seeing this fast and loose way that people are operating without respect for other people.
I'm not going to address each of those situations because they're different and not everybody
different.
Knows the background on all of them. But I always felt that, the goal for my column was not only to let people, know what was going on and what had happened and kind of some of the details and background of what went into a situation that just call us to be better and hold us accountable to being, in all of those situations say, this was mishandled, this was a mess, this was not the way humane or polite civil people, interact. And to help people, say it's okay to apologize, it's okay
yes.
to recognize your mistake, and it's a goad for all of us to do better next time, know? I mean, my goal was always to encourage people to be informed, engaged, and active in the community so that we could be a better community, so we could be a more cohesive, inclusive community. And, it's sad to me, and I don't think it's my fault. I don't blame myself entirely, but it's sad to me that unfortunately art has kind of gone in a different a different direction. We seem to be less forgiving, less inclusive.
Less accountable, too.
And less accountable, yeah.
There's a way that to acknowledge we are humans, we are going to mess up. But there's kind of this, anyone who disagrees with me through, you know, shooting the messenger, calling them names, whatever it was, deflecting, really, from the issue. You want to make it about the person or their personality, not actually about the issue. And to be, which is what I try to do when I write, like, let's just look at the facts here and what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And does this serve us, right? Is this really the best thing? You know, from where I sit, the Fourth Estate, the press, that is their function. And to have the columnist in there clearly showing that this is an opinion, but it's an opinion based on facts, right? It is an informed opinion. It's not just someone popping off. We need that at every level. And without it, you know, one of my favorite quotes from a founding father is John Adams. He said, you know, you might deflect and you might reframe and all that, but at the end of the day, if your budget doesn't balance, it doesn't balance. If you're investing in something foolish, it's foolish. And we need to have robust, fact-based discussions about these things. And that, you know, I think is the value of local journalism and a column like yours.
Yeah, I mean, I really did try hard to make sure that my opinions were based on good reporting and solid reporting. I never asked anybody to agree with my opinion, and mm-hmm. I was happy to interact with readers who didn't.
Right.
But I did try to really do my homework and make sure that the conclusion I came to was based on well-researched fact. And mm-hmm. one of the things that I was probably proudest of in terms of the column was I did have readers who almost never agreed with me, and I heard from them. Mm-hmm. And we would have sometimes very contentious little email exchanges, you know? But I feel like they respected me. And
of course, if they were interacting with you.
I have to say there's one guy in general, and if he's listening to this, he'll know who he is, who we had many back and forths over the years, often disagreed. But he appreciated the quality of my writing. He appreciated mm-hmm. my effort. And he recently sent me a copy of an email he had sent to the paper telling them, the paper, that he was canceling his subscription because I'd left, which made me sad because I hate to see anyone, you know, yeah. Desert a local news source. But at the same time, I felt like, you know, this goes against the grain when people say we can't get along, we can't discuss, we can't, you know, share different opinions and still respect each other, because I encountered that, you know, many times over.
Yes, yeah. One of the columns or topics you wrote about, because before there was controversy in the school board with, you know, what happened with Bridget Ziegler, Todd Bowden had left, and he was the superintendent who left before Brennan Asplund came in. And there was a plan to make Gocio Elementary a community school. And this was a plan that included all kinds of, because it was, is it the title, now I'm forgetting, what kind of a school is it where there's a significant portion of the children, Title I, okay. Mm-hmm. And those children, they were going to coordinate all kinds of services to support the families, to support the kids. And because Bowden left, I think it was an excuse, honestly. I don't know that because, and Bowden, I guess, was an advocate for that, but they said, well, given what's going on with the transition and we need to select a new superintendent, we're not going to be able to have a community school. You had written about that. And I just look at, there were forces who have been relentless about vouchers that didn't want resources going to That's just my reading of the tea leaves. But I think that your coverage of that was really appreciated. And it was just one of the saddest things that was abandoned, you know, for a reason that honestly didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. I think it was an excuse. So I'm curious to know what you thought.
You know, that story, it feels so far long ago to me, and I don't remember all of the details of it. I do remember studying the community school model, which is a really wonderful model and has been successful elsewhere. I don't remember all the details of the specifics of it.
But see, that's because I've studied things in depth like that I've written about. And then I'm like, oh, gosh. And it was like, this was probably 7 years ago or 6 years ago. And the level of detail that you learn. And then I've become an archivist, right? I keep a lot of things because if I ever have to go back, I know I can't rely on just my memory.
Well, it's so funny because people would come up to me and say, oh, I loved your column last week. And I'd be going like, what did I write about last week? Because honestly, I did have to kind of do a deep dive and educate myself on a lot of these subjects. I felt like I was just Joe Citizen. I mean, a lot of times coming into these things, I didn't know what they were talking about. I didn't know, and I had to learn and educate myself quickly. And my goal was always, how can I, I don't want to say
you're
this.
A translator. You have to translate it to somebody who comes at it where you were knowing nothing.
Well, and I had to simplify it without trying to introduce any mistakes. So
yes.
I would always tell people, I do that because I have to get it in the big complex. I have to try to simplify it for me to understand.
We're dealing with complexity and we're experts in all, which educates readers on what can be very technical information in a way that's understandable to line zero. That is where all that work comes in, and I've done it too, and it's challenging.
Yeah, I know you have. I know you have. So I know you know as well as anyone what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it is, and it's a very much needed skill in our world today, taking it
accurately,
being true to the content. Right. So, Carrie Seedman, I know many people want to know what's next for you. Is there a way maybe you'll continue to write about local issues? Are you kind of taking a sabbatical? Do you have other thoughts about what you might do?
I've made a pledge to myself not to rush into anything. I have several personal projects, a couple of books that I'm working on. For those of readers of the column, they know that I'm also dealing with my home having been flooded by both hurricanes,
yes.
And I'm still displaced from my home. Talking to a lot of people about a lot of potential, you know, projects or options. I still have my mental health Substack account, which is called Facing Mental Illness. Mm-hmm. And we are about to launch a new mental health arts collaborative project.
Oh, that's great.
I'm just opening myself to the possibilities of the universe.
Okay. Well, that's an exciting place to be. If readers, you know, want to follow you, they can look for you on Substack, right?
Yes, although that work is not my column. I mean, I don't want to be misleading.
No.
It's all about mental health issues. It's not, has nothing to do with the work that I did for the Herald Tribune. But yes, I'd certainly invite them to take a look.
Okay, well, Carrie Seedman, thank you so much for the work that you've done for Sarasota. I'm really sad that you won't be there anymore. You've been a wonderful voice of, you know, compassion and education, and deeply honor what you've contributed to our community. I'm very excited to see what you may do next.
Thank you, Kathy. It was a real honor and a privilege, seriously, to be able to be a voice for the residents. And I just want to say to all my readers, thank you. So are wonderfully supportive, and I miss hearing from them.
Okay. Everybody, thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to The Detail on WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, and WBPV 100.1 LPFM in Bradenton, Florida. Happy 20th anniversary to you, our amazing WSLR community. For two decades, your support has made everything we do possible. Now we want to hear from you. Please take a moment to fill out our 2025 listener survey and help shape the future of WSLR. It's quick and easy. Just visit WSLR.org and click the banner on our homepage. And thank you once again for 20 incredible years. Be sure to stay tuned now for more public affairs programming here on WSLR. Make it a great day.
Now, you're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. From From New York, this is Democracy Now!
My name is Jackson Reffitt, and I reported the authorities on my dad's, you know, far-right behavior leading up to January 6th, and even though his violent actions were absolutely destroyed my family, now he's pardoned, and I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm in hiding.
As President Trump defends his sweeping pardons for the January 6th insurrectionists, we'll speak with a young man who fears for his life after Trump pardoned his father, who'd been sentenced. We'll also look at Trump's decision to withdraw the U.S. from the World Health Organization while freezing communication and canceling upcoming meetings of the National Institutes of Health and other agencies. Then to the occupied territories while ceasefires. Israel is intensifying attacks on the West Bank. The Israeli military has killed at least 13 people in Jenin in recent days, while Israeli settlers carry out a new wave of attacks.
What they failed to achieve in Gaza, they are trying to make. Jenin is the center